You're listening to the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway, and we're recording this at 13 hours GMT on Monday, the 1st of July. Is the far right about to take power in France?
Our party is not the monster it has been presented as. The fact that we love our country does not mean that we hate others.
But President Macron is calling for centrist and left-wing parties to unite against the national rally in the second round of voting next Sunday. It was the earliest Category 4 hurricane ever recorded. Now Storm Beryl is taking aim at the Caribbean. And the US Justice Department is accused of offering Boeing a sweetheart deal over fatal 737 MAX airline crashes. Also in the podcast, we hear about the Sudanese children fleeing the conflict in Darfur.
We suffered a lot because of the security situation. Now, I believe I'm in a safe place. Even for my pupils, they can't get a good education if they don't feel safe.
We look back at the life of the Albanian writer and poet Ismail Kadare, who's died at the age of 88, and an admission charge to climb Mount Fuji. But first, one thing that's clear after the first round of the French election, the far right is now closer to power than at any time since the Second World War. Marine Le Pen's Rassemblement National won a third of the vote on Sunday. And as campaigning gets underway for the second round next weekend, President Macron has called for centrist and left-wing blocs to join forces to stop the far right winning control of Parliament. So what does France make of the results so far? Here's the view from Paris.
It's scary. The far right is a bit of a shock. It's a bit difficult for young people that there's a party who's in the lead who cares very little about us. We're wondering whether others feel the same way. Do other young people feel the same way? It's a bit difficult.
What do I think? A bit disappointed in France, actually. It's not the France that I knew as a child. But now, that's how it is. That's what happens. It's chaos, in fact.
But National Rally candidate Ivanka Dimitrova says the party wants to unify all the people of France as long as they live like the French.
I think the work that we have started a long time ago has given its first results. We are convincing people that our party is not the monster it has been presented as, and that the fact that we love our country and our people does not mean that we hate others. Not at all.
Our Paris correspondent Hugh Schofield told us more about how people in France have reacted to the National Rally's success.
They're not surprised because the polls said this was coming. It's come. No one can say that there wasn't any forewarning. Nonetheless, there is a sense of us moving into new terrain, and that requires a sense of adapting your brain to a new reality. Among many people, particularly in the big cities like Paris, there's absolute dismay and anger. But, you know, let's not forget, Paris and the other big cities are not France, and it's quite clear that outside of the big cities, the National Rally is hugely popular, and there people are no doubt saying, well, things are moving our way. What is clear and what unites everyone is a feeling that France is on the verge of a major political change, though what that change will be hasn't been determined. There is another round of this election, and a lot hinges on that second round, because it will make the difference between a National Rally government with an absolute majority and thus able to govern, and one that has no majority or only a relative majority and is thus unable to do anything in Parliament, which means a whole new set of problems for the country.
Yeah, I mean, let's look at how things will pan out next weekend. The National Rally got about a third of the vote. That means two-thirds of people didn't vote for them. Will they be able to join forces? Because you've got the centrists, but then also this new popular front on the left, which also has some extreme elements.
There's the rub, and we just don't know. You know, you look on paper and you think, well, in the natural course of events, there's more people who are against the National Front than there are people who are for it. Therefore, they should be able to keep it out or keep the gains down. If this was a presidential election, that would certainly apply, and, you know, would at least it certainly applied in the past. And, you know, at every presidential election, when it's, you know, been Marine Le Pen against someone else, people come together to block the National Rally candidate. This is a different situation because it's constituency-based. There are local candidates with local loyalties and so on. And also the political world is changing. People are far, far less reluctant to say openly that they vote for the National Rally. The normalisation is complete. On the left, you have this alliance which includes the party, the LFI, the France Unbowed, which is, in many people's eyes, also totally unpalatable and unacceptable. In Le Figaro, for example, the conservative newspaper, for the first time they had an editorial today saying that LFI, the left, the far left, is worse than the far right. So effectively saying, you know, if we have to choose, we will choose the far right. And that's new.
Hugh Schofield in Paris. The National Rally has said it wants to combat what it calls Islamist ideologies and would like to change the law to make it easier to close mosques and ban the Muslim headscarf. One in 10 adults in France identifies as Muslim. Rob Young has been gauging opinion on the rise of the National Rally and its policies at a mosque in northern France.
The call to prayer by the imam signals the start of the main weekly worship. Hundreds of men and women have streamed into this large mosque outside Lille, their shoes removed and neatly arranged in the corridors. Religious duty is the main thing on their minds, but there's also anxiety about the possibility of a National Rally government. Here's Nordine, who's an IT engineer and moved to France from Morocco 40 years ago.
Of course there's some worry. I'm a father of four children. All my children are educated and taking on higher studies, as are many people of the Muslim faith. Muslims in France are a minority, and within that minority, there's perhaps a minority that's a little lost when it comes to education and their future. And so there's a focus on these people rather than the 80% of law-abiding Muslims. So that creates a feeling of worry in France, and the media zooms in on this and incites a far-right electorate. We'll be watching where things go. I think there are a lot of Muslims who will make a decision. There's testimony from many highly qualified Muslims who are leaving France because the pressure on them is just too much.
My name is Bilal and I'm 18 years old. I'm a little bit worried about the rise of the Front National because discrimination they make about Muslim people. This is going to be really difficult to a Muslim to live in peace in France if the Front National come to power. I love France for many reasons, like it's my country. I want to live in France for the rest of my life. But if I had the choice to the religion or the country, I'm going to choose my religion.
In the part of the mosque reserved for women, doctor and mum of three Imen, who left Tunisia 18 years ago, is wearing a black headscarf known as a hijab, a garment the National Rally wants to ban in public places.
En tant que femme musulmane, déjà, il y a des difficultés.
As a Muslim woman in France, there are already difficulties, but they are limited. What worries me is new laws like the National Rally's promise to ban the hijab in public space. This is a country we chose. We chose it for its values, human rights, its values of inclusion, freedom, equality and fraternity. So having a party like the National Rally come to power is not what we wanted. But this fear won't stop me from living, and it won't stop me from doing what I want to do as a Muslim woman, but also as a French woman.
Outside the mosque, an anti-racism campaigner is handing out leaflets urging people to vote. This worshipper, Hamid, who is originally from Algeria, says he will vote, but insists he isn't scared about the prospect of a National Rally government.
C'est vrai, ça m'inquiète. Par contre, ça me fait pas peur.
It worries me, but it doesn't scare me. Worry and fear are not the same thing. I think France is already very intolerant anyway, and I'm not sure National Rally is going to change anything about that. The problem already exists. Is the National Rally going to get rid of all the Muslims in France? That's impossible. So, as a Muslim living in France, I will stay here with my wife and my children, and I will keep my religion.
People there speaking to Rob Young in Lille in northern France. Beryl, the first named hurricane of the season, is now just 125 kilometres or so from the Caribbean island of Grenada and moving at a speed of about 30 kilometres an hour. St Vincent and the Grenadines is also at risk of life-threatening winds and a storm surge. And the Prime Minister there, Ralph Gonsalves, had this warning.
Hurricane Beryl is moving toward the west, northwest. Don't risk going to sea. Take up your boat. Pull up your boat. We have to prepare, organize, and wait this monster out.
As the hurricane moved towards the Windward Islands, I spoke to Chris Forkes from BBC Weather.
Hurricane Beryl has sustained winds of 120 miles an hour, which is 195 kilometres an hour, but with stronger gusts. The gusts are reaching around 145 miles an hour, which is 235 kilometres an hour. Now, the thing with hurricanes is the really fierce winds tend to be quite localised around the eye of the storm. And so if you travel 30 miles outside of the eye, then the winds drop off quite dramatically, below 70 miles an hour, for example, below about 110 kilometres an hour or around about that speed. Now, I think one of the things with Beryl is it's moving quite quickly forward. So it's moving at a forward speed of about 20 miles an hour. And the only good thing I'd say about that is it doesn't allow enormous rainfall totals to build up because it moves through quite quickly. And so we're looking at something like 100 to 250 millimetres of rain. It's still enough to cause some significant, even some severe flooding problems, but in the grand scheme of hurricanes, it could be worse.
Talking about the grand scheme of hurricanes, we're quite early in the season, runs from June to November. Beryl, the first Category 4 ever recorded in June, and we're also seeing Tropical Storm Chris forming around Mexico. What is in store for this season?
Well, you're right. This season is expected to be exceptionally busy. And there's a few reasons for that. You know, if we look at the ocean temperatures around the planet, we've had 13 consecutive months of not just above average temperatures, but of record temperatures. And it's the heat that in the oceans that actually powers these hurricanes. So that's one factor. The other is actually, you know, you might have heard about El Nino, La Nina kind of patterns. We had El Nino last year. And one thing with hurricanes is they don't like strong winds around them. It kind of disturbs the circulation. And so in El Nino years, you find that you don't often get very many Atlantic hurricanes. So last year, relatively quiet. This year, we're coming away from that. We're in a neutral pattern at the moment, and we're heading towards a La Nina pattern. And that also increases the likelihood of storms. So in terms of the season as a whole, this year, we're expecting 8 to 13 hurricanes. An average season would bring us 7. And of those hurricanes, we're expecting around 4 to 7 major hurricanes. The average is 3. So Beryl, the first major hurricane in what is expected to be an incredibly busy season.
Chris Forkes. And since I spoke to Chris, Hurricane Beryl has regained strength into a Category 4 hurricane with maximum sustained winds of 215 kilometres an hour. It's been called a sweetheart plea deal. Lawyers for the families of those who died in two plane crashes say the aircraft manufacturer Boeing will be ordered to pay a fine of just $240 million. 346 people died in the 737 MAX crashes in 2018 and 2019. The families are not happy about the agreement from the US Department of Justice, as I heard from our business correspondent Nick Marsh.
Yeah, well, we've been in touch, Ollie, with Paul Cassell, who's the lawyer that's representing 15 families of the victims of those plane crashes. And he said that the DOJ is offering this deal to Boeing whereby it will plead guilty to fraud, face that fine that you mentioned. He calls it a small fine and a 3-year probationary period. And that way, Boeing avoids going to trial and admitting that it was directly responsible for those 346 deaths. That's the deal that's supposedly on the table. We've had no comment from Boeing or the Department of Justice yet. That's what he and the lawyers are saying to us, and Paul Cassell said he's been told that directly by DOJ officials, and that's the plan. I'll just back up a little bit, Ollie, and just explain the timeline of how we got here, because in 2021, Boeing promised the DOJ it would improve its safety culture and its ethics in the aftermath of those 737 crashes, and in return, it would avoid criminal charges. It also paid a $2.5 billion fine there as well. Now, as we know, in the intervening time since, there's been an awful lot of incidents. You know, the door coming off the Alaska Airlines flight, whistleblowers, you know, saying that corners are being cut when it comes to safety and so on. So the DOJ is basically saying, look, Boeing has broken that agreement. Improvements have not been made. So we're going to charge them with fraud for breaking that agreement. But with this option of a plea deal, and then clearly that's not gone down well with the families.
Yeah, tell us more about how they are likely to react to this.
So we've been told that they will strenuously object to this plea. That's a quote. I mean, it's already been called a sweetheart deal by the lawyers, you know, Boeing getting off lightly. And even when it comes to the fine, we've had no confirmation, but there is that sort of figure of around $250 million-ish. When you consider that the families are asking for $25 billion, you can see how disappointing an outcome this would be for them. It's not set in stone. Like I said, we've had no confirmation from Boeing or the DOJ, and a judge would still need to approve this plea deal. So it's not all finalized, but if it does materialize, it would be a very controversial development indeed for Boeing, for the families, for everyone, really.
Nick Marsh, our business correspondent. The Albanian writer and poet Ismail Kadare has died at the age of 88. As the first winner of the International Booker Prize in 2005, Kadare was regarded as one of the most accomplished European writers of our times. His works have been translated into more than 45 languages. Arian Kochi looks back at his life.
Ismail Kadare defied simple categorization. For much of his literary career, he was lauded as a potential Nobel Prize winner, but also criticized as a sycophant of the Albanian communist dictatorship in the 1960s and 80s. His stories are rooted in events and myths of his native Albania, but critics say his novels have a timeless relevance and universal appeal. Born in 1936 in Gjirokastër in southern Albania, Kadare studied literature in Tirana and Moscow. His return home in 1960 coincided with Albania's diplomatic rift with the Soviet Union, which Kadare chronicled in his work The Great Winter, which has been criticized for praising the communist Albanian leader Enver Hoxha. Kadare did not help matters with his honest admission that he never considered himself a dissident, insisting he was not a political writer. Although he was deeply interested in Albanian politics, he took refuge in historical and allegorical fiction. His masterpiece, The Palace of Dreams, is set in Istanbul, the capital of the Ottoman Empire, where dreams are scrutinized for signs of political unrest. It is seen as an allegory of the authoritarian regime's mania for surveillance. In awarding him the first International Booker Prize in 2005 for his whole body of work, the jury described Kadare as a writer who maps a whole culture, a universal writer in the tradition of storytelling that goes back to Homer.
Arian Kochi on Ismail Kadare, who's died at the age of 88. And still to come on the Global News podcast, the pop star who saved the day for football-hungry fans at Glastonbury Music Festival. The fighting between rival factions in Sudan has forced millions of people, many of them children, to flee, with huge numbers now living in refugee camps across the border in eastern Chad. A new school at the Meche camp, which hosts over 40,000 people, is giving some of the children a chance to resume at least a semblance of normal life. The BBC's Paul Ngie travelled to Meche to find out more.
The boisterous singing of Sudanese children living at the Meche refugee camp in eastern Chad belies the horrors of war that they witnessed in the Darfur region. They now welcome life in their new school, built with tin roofs and flapping tarpaulin walls. Even though the children sit on mats instead of desks and benches, their enthusiasm to learn remains strong.
This is capital E. All of you say capital E.
Teacher Hanan Adam, herself a refugee in the camp, takes them through the paces of the day's lesson. She relieves the challenges they faced when the rebel rapid support forces targeted civilians in her native West Darfur state.
We suffered a lot because of the security situation. Now, I believe I'm in a safe place. Even for my pupils, they can't get a good education if they don't feel safe.
12-year-old Ahmed happily joins in the lesson.
I spent 7 to 8 months without education because of war. And when I arrived here in Chad, I was out of school for months. Now I have found the school and I'm very happy because I got new friends. I thought I had no future.
Unfortunately, only 1,800 of the 23,000 children living in the camp can attend the new school due to limited resources. After school, Ahmed takes us home to meet his younger brother Jamar al-Din, who hasn't secured a place in the school.
The situation is very bad. I'm not happy because while my brother is in school, I am out of school. This means my future is not clear.
The Norwegian Refugee Council runs the school. Shelter officer Isam Adam says they need more support to expand the project.
In Meche alone, we need more than 4 schools. There are about 5 other camps in eastern Chad also in need of education, plus other aspects like shelter.
For now, the children in Teacher Hanan's classroom keep their dreams of a brighter future alive.
Paul Njie reporting from eastern Chad. Over the past 15 years, northeastern Nigeria has faced devastating attacks from Islamist militants. On Saturday, suicide bombers killed at least 18 people and left more than 40 injured in 3 separate attacks in the regional town of Goza in Borno State. The attackers, all thought to be women, targeted a wedding, a hospital and a funeral. Professor Usman Tar, Borno State's Commissioner for Information and Internal Security, told us who they thought were responsible.
The intelligence available to us indicates that the attack was carried out by the Boko Haram terrorist group because the government of Borno State is resettling the people of Goza and other villages, and they appear not to be happy about that. They wanted the Goza area to be ungoverned space, but government wanted to resettle the people, and the resettlement plan has gone far. So they prepared this attack in order to sabotage the effort of the government. That is what we can say for now. But the fact is, terrorists took advantage of a social assembly. And what we will do is to beef up security protocol during gatherings to make sure that such an event do not take place again. The government would, on its part, will work harder than ever before in order to make sure that this event does not repeat itself again. Enough is enough.
Professor Usman Tar in Nigeria. With only 3 days to go before the UK's general election, one of the big issues is the price of homes. But are any of the political parties able to convince people they can solve Britain's housing crunch? Leanna Byrne from Marketplace has been taking a look.
So that's bedroom number 1.
If you want to understand the UK's housing market right now, the best thing to do is go looking to buy a home. Meenreet Kaur is 43 and lives in a small 2-bed house in London. She's a full-time carer for her parents. Since her mom was diagnosed with blood cancer, she says her family needs more space, but she's struggling to find a bigger house within her $770,000 budget. That's close to her mom's hospital.
So how did you feel about that one?
Didn't like it at all. There's no light. It was really dull. Cracks in the walls.
On the way to our next viewing, Meenreet tells me that she's sick of people telling her to move further away from London.
You can do that if it's just yourself. But when you're a carer and you've got your elderly parents, it's just not feasible.
The Conservative Party, which is currently in government, is promising to waive a home buyer tax for first-time buyers like Meenreet for properties costing up to $540,000. But she's looking in Slough, a town to the west of London, where average property prices are $570,000. So she'll miss out.
Where are you going to get a house in the area of London? You're not going to. You're going to have to move really far.
At house number two, Minreet isn't impressed.
This one is 598.
Wow, it's really expensive. It's going to need a lot of work.
The average property price paid by a first-time buyer in the UK last year was just over $250,000. Private rental costs have gone up by more than 9%, according to the UK's Office for National Statistics. Peter Felix and his partner Rebecca Wilson are in their early 40s and have been renting together in the city of Birmingham in mid-England for nearly 3 years.
It's quite depressing that you can go out and earn a decent wage but not be able to afford to buy a property because your money is going towards the rent.
The opposition Labour Party says it wants to extend an existing scheme which helps people get a mortgage with a smaller deposit. But Peter says saving for a small deposit is challenging.
The rents will keep going up, and we know that every time the rent goes up, it means there's less and less in our pocket to save.
Availability of public housing is another issue. Labour is promising more. But Osman Ahmadi, an Uber driver who's been waiting for 3 years, is sceptical any change will happen.
I have seen a lot of people. I've got all the letters, I've got all the proofs, and nothing's been done.
Meanwhile, Minreet has finished her viewings for the day.
I just feel so deflated. I didn't like that at all.
This is my biggest issue with the elections. I just feel this is all I'm thinking about, day in, day out, going round and round in circles, and I'm getting really depressed about it.
According to UK price comparison website Moneyfacts, people in the UK spend on average more than a quarter of their disposable income on housing. That will be sure to play into many voting decisions on the day of the UK's election, July the 4th.
Leanna Byrne reporting. People hoping to climb Japan's famous volcano, Mount Fuji, using its most popular route, must now pay a $13 charge. The authorities are trying to limit the numbers scaling Japan's highest peak. More from our Asia-Pacific regional editor, Celia Hatton.
Last year, more than 220,000 people scaled Mount Fuji between July and September. Officials are hoping to drastically reduce that number. They're frustrated by congested paths littered with piles of rubbish. A rising number of hikers have also needed emergency medical treatment, either because of altitude sickness, hypothermia, or simply because they're poorly equipped to scale Mount Fuji's 12,000-foot summit. Some have attempted to withstand the summit's sub-zero temperatures in shorts and flimsy sandals. Starting today, only 4,000 people a day will be permitted onto the Yoshida Trail, Mount Fuji's most popular path. And a gate halfway up will close after 4 p.m. It's aimed at turning away those who try to hike overnight to reach the peak at sunrise, the same group that often require the most emergency medical attention.
Our Asia-Pacific regional editor, Celia Hatton. A corner of southwest London is the focus of tennis fans today as the Wimbledon Championships gets underway. There's been plenty of talk of a changing of the guard in men's tennis recently, and this year could mark the final appearances of the likes of former champions Novak Djokovic and Andy Murray. Djokovic has just had knee surgery but is well known for battling through physical setbacks. What doesn't change from year to year is the famous queue. Many people camped out overnight to secure tickets. Our reporter Ollie Samuels spoke to some of them.
We got here Friday afternoon.
And what number, dare I ask, are you in the queue?
We are 4 and 5.
That's incredible. And where have you come from
to be here?
We come
from Houston, Texas.
And what is it about Wimbledon that is so special?
It's the mecca of tennis. It's the most beautiful tournament. It's the origin of it all. It's, you know, the beauty, the great tennis, the great people, the camaraderie that's out here in the queue. Everything is just, the atmosphere is phenomenal.
Well, our reporter in Wimbledon itself is Shabnam Yunus Jewell. So given that talk of a change in the guard, do things feel different this year?
I'm at Centre Court right now, and it does, particularly in the men's game, as you mentioned, because, you know, those big names aren't really there anymore, and there are doubts over the two that are remaining, Novak Djokovic and Andy Murray, whether they're even going to play and whether it's the last one. We've got all eyes today on Carlos Alcaraz. He is the big new thing, isn't he? The Spaniard, only 21 years old, and has won three majors already. He's come in as defending champion, a really special year for him, this, and just off the back of winning the French Open as well. So looking for back-to-back wins here. I think his name is on many people's lips, and as well as Jannik Sinner, the new world number one. He's on court number one today. And another name that I think many people are looking forward to watching. And those two, I think, are developing into rivals, into two very exciting players. And they're the ones that are taking over now, I think, which happens, you know, in every generation of every sport, new players come in and they take over and they become those icons of the sport. So, yeah, definitely in the men's game that's happening. So the big stories today with Murray and Djokovic. Well, Djokovic has said, even though he had that knee surgery, that he is going to be playing and he wants to be considered one of the favourites still. You can never knock that determination and fighting spirit that he has. It's almost a stubbornness, isn't it? And if he won a record-equalling eighth title this year, that would be his biggest achievement yet. On Andy Murray, well, we've got to wait to find out whether he's going to play in the singles. He's fighting to be fit. He had back surgery recently, which has spoiled his plans for Wimbledon a little bit. And he said he's going to decide later today whether he'll play his singles match tomorrow. He might just play in the doubles. It'll give him a bit more time to recover. He might play with his brother. And yeah, this could be his farewell. Well, it most likely is his farewell Wimbledon, and he wants that opportunity to play it one more time out there. So yeah, this possibly could be your last chance to see those two big names this year.
In the women's game, we got used to the dominance of the Williams sisters for many years in Wimbledon. Who should we look out for this year?
Yeah, it's definitely a lot more open in the women's game. We've had, you know, brand new winners for the last 6 years since the dominance of the Williams sisters. So you've got a few players you can look at. We had, the first unseeded player to win last year, Markéta Vondrousova of the Czech Republic, coming in again. We've got Coco Gauff. She is, of course, a prodigy here since she beat Venus Williams at the age of 15 5 years ago. She'll be one of the favourites this year. Ons Jabeur, we call her the Minister of Happiness. We've had tears from her. She could be another favourite here this year as well. And then, of course, we've got the world number one, Iga Swiatek. Not done so good on grass before, but let's see how she does.
Now let's end on a story that brought a smile to some people this weekend. With the European Football Championships in full swing, some music fans at the UK's largest festival, Glastonbury, didn't want to miss out on watching the game between England and Slovakia. And a surprise helper came to their rescue. None other than Louis Tomlinson, one of the stars of the pop band One Direction. He managed to get a flat screen that he bought the same day, took it to the festival area, and made sure that at least one group of people could enjoy, if that's the right word, watching England. Our culture and media editor Katie Razzle caught up with a pop star by the makeshift setup.
You are the god of this festival because football wasn't officially on anywhere, but you sorted it out. How did you do that?
It was a little... Well, we brought a TV in, very Glasgow, in some, like, stones in a little stand. It was a little bit touch and go at times because the signal kept going in and out, but, yeah, luckily we got the win. We pulled it off. Made up.
Well done.
Yeah, a little bit touch and go, rather like England's performance, but fortunately the country was rescued by that acrobatic goal from Jude Bellingham. And that is all from us for now, but the Global News podcast will be back very soon. This edition was mixed by Tom Bartlett and produced by Stephanie Zacherson. Our editor's Karen Martin. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.